Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I'm your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you are having a beautiful Saturday. Hope we maybe you're enjoying the Fiesta events this weekend, and hope we can help make your weekend even more of a Fiesta by bringing you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. Joining me to do so, as he does so very often on this show, please welcome from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel, Jeremy Branch.
Our schedule's been a little bit wonky lately, so it's always good to be able to catch up and kind of talk about some of the current things going on in the world of pop culture. One thing that we kind of missed a little bit, just again due to scheduling and things like that, is that Cannes Film Festival happened sometime last week, maybe a little later at time of recording, and there's some movies, Julio, that were getting massive reactions from audiences. Have you heard about any of the extended standing ovations of some of these movies?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of tends to happen at film festivals. I know Furiosa got like an 8-minute standing ovation. We're going to be talking about that movie more in detail later on in the show. But yeah, a lot of the winner, the films that were the winners at the festival, that sort of thing, got these big long standing ovations. It's a thing that happens. Why, you got a take on it?
Well, I just find it very interesting that as I'm kind of looking at the recap and some of the headlines that came out of Cannes Film Festival, if every movie is getting a 10-minute standing ovation, then at what point does it not even become like something that should be acknowledged anymore, right? Like, there's this movie called The Substance. I mean, it stars Demi Moore. It's got Dennis Quaid and Margaret Qualley in it, all extremely talented people that have been responsible for acting in some really good movies. And actually, it was directed by Coralie Fargeau, who did Revenge a couple years back.
I mean, I'd give Margaret Qualley a 10-minute standing ovation just on principle.
And maybe that's what it is. Maybe the whole room is just filled with people that are just so into the actors or the actresses that they feel obligated. Does the fact that the filmmakers are present play a factor in this?
Oh, yeah, of course it does. I mean, some of it is performative. Don't get me wrong. Some of it is, I'm going to make a show of I really like this movie. But yeah, it is the difference between a standing ovation in the theater at a festival versus people applauding at the end of a movie and, just a paid screening. They went to see, a movie on opening night and everybody's excited at the end, is that you do have an audience for your applause, for lack of a better term. If you're applauding in the theater, it's like, okay, that's great. Nobody's really there to appreciate the fact that you're applauding in the theater other than, you and your fellow theater goers enjoyed the film. But when you're at a screening at a big festival like this, where chances are the directors there, the producers are there, some of the actors, or maybe all of the actors are there, then it is a chance to show your appreciation to the people that actually made the film. So they're there.
The one that I just now mentioned, it got a 9-minute standing ovation. The new Donald Trump movie starring Sebastian Stan called The Apprentice got a nearly 8-minute standing ovation. Does that mean that The Apprentice is a slightly less good movie than the other one?
Or it had a slightly less enthusiastic crowd, or it, more people wanted to sit down, more people's feet were hurting. There's no science to this. And I mean, there's that thing of the entertainment media, like timing the standing ovations. That's just kind of silly.
Would you be the first person to sit down?
It depends. I mean, if I didn't like the movie, I ain't getting up, even if everybody else gets up.
I think that's what makes you a unique case, Julio. I was kind of maybe overthinking this thing, and I'm like, is this how communism happens, right? Like, is this the equivalent of I was just doing my job where like you see a crowd of people get up and do this thing and you don't want to be the one person that doesn't do the thing, so you just assimilate and all of a sudden now you're part of the problem and people are publishing articles about Cannes Film Festival and you are personally a part of the reason why people stood and clapped for 10 minutes straight. That is an insanely long amount of time. That is longer than, it's almost as long as one of our segments. That's wild.
I mean, I think there are a lot more insidious things that lead to the rise of, you know.
Nope.
That lead to the rise of, you know, a dictatorship or authoritarian governments. And that is a topic we could go into great detail about if we chose to. However, we're not going to because it's not that kind of show. Now, I mean, yeah, there's a little bit of following the herd, too. There is a little bit of I don't want to be the first one to sit down. I don't think it's just that's limited to film festivals. It's, you know, it's any kind of accolade, any kind of, you know, situation where you are paying tribute to somebody who's there to enjoy having tribute paid to them to whatever extent, whether they, you know, are receiving a lifetime achievement award or they've just won an Oscar, you know, a competitive Oscar or whatever. You know, somebody that just had just did a stage performance. They were in a stage play. They did a concert, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, how long do the cheers go on when the band leaves the stage before they come back for the encore?
I think we need to set a societal standard of 60 seconds. If you do it for longer than 60 seconds, you are a crazy person, and that should be just the accepted rule moving forward. 60 seconds, get it all out. Cheer, you know what I mean? Whoop and holler and all of that stuff, all within your 60 seconds. Be normal. Don't be weird, people.
I have so many off-color jokes to make about that. It's like, if you're only doing it for 60 seconds, you're doing it wrong, my friend. but at any rate, you know, it's not hurting anybody. I think the thing that maybe hurts anybody more than anything is this whole, like, obsession of the entertainment media to time those standing ovations.
You're right.
To put it out there, it's something. Yeah, and I say this as somebody who worked in the media for 20 years. I get it. When you're critiquing the media, I think I come from a little bit more of a place of knowing both sides of it than others. But it becomes that thing of, you know, another great example is this thing of there with, you know, as many of you know, I work on Pensacon, and it becomes this thing of, anytime we're doing a media interview, we have to stress because people have this misconception that they have to come to the con in costume. Because when they see media coverage of the con, they see lots of people in costumes.
Right.
Because the media turns their cameras on the costumes because it's the most visually interesting thing that's happening. So that's what they see when they see convention on TV or in, you know, the newspaper or any kind of visual media, even on social media. You know, so then they get it in their head that I can't go unless I go in costume. And it's interesting because we just got back some research from this past year's Pensacon, and it's getting close to 50-50 on people who are showing up in costume and who don't.
That's amazingly close. I had no idea. I would have thought 25% of people in costume.
Yeah, I would have thought it was significantly less too, but yeah, it's running about 45-55.
Interesting.
Which I find very interesting. But yeah, we always have to stress because the flip side is there are people that just aren't comfortable getting dressed up in costume or can't afford to get a costume or whatever, and we still want them to come to the show.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason that you can't come and enjoy the show not being in a costume. And so I always try to stress, hey, no, you absolutely do not have to come in costume. Lots of people come and not in costume and have a great time. So it's that same kind of thing where the coverage begets the perception. So that performative thing of, well, this film got a 10-minute standing ovation at Cannes is part of the, well, this must be a great film if people are standing up and clapping for 10 minutes about it. And so I've got to go see that movie because it's so great. And this is going to be, you know, a possible Oscar winner. And that may be true. It may be not true. You know, look at a critical eye when you're looking at these things is really the bottom line. Got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Analyst channel on YouTube. And, you know, all right, I recognize that the Mad Max saga does not take place in the Painted Desert. I recognize that that is a different desert than the desert that we're implied to be seeing in these movies. But it's a great song. Can't go wrong with a little 10,000.
Can you acknowledge to the listeners at home that I suggested Fuel by Metallica and that that's what you played instead?
Yeah, because you know what?
Metallica sucks. Let me hear.
No, that is not what I was going to say. What I was going to say is Metallica stopped existing after the Black Album.
Yeah, I thought you would say something like that, Julio.
Like I'm down with Metallica up to and including the Black Album. After the Black Album, they're dead to me.
Mm-hmm.
Just dead to me, because it's just all just terrible.
You don't think Fuel is a good song?
No, I do
all
not.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah. And yeah,
fair enough.
I get where you're going, but I mean, symbolically, I get where you're going. Yeah, Fuel is such an issue in the Mad Max movies, and it's, you know, it's more aggressive, and these movies are big, high-octane action movies. So I get where you'd feel it was appropriate.
Uh-huh.
If it wasn't a cruddy song.
Fair enough. What about, all right, let's talk about.
And in fairness, it's funny. We'll get to the movie in just a second, but we do kind of sometimes like go back and forth about what we're going to play for music. And I end up picking, but, you know, we do end up going back and forth and throwing some ideas back and forth, that sort of thing. And, yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about like all the songs that are about deserts. And it's like, well, no, I don't want to do Desert Rose by Sting because that's lame. And I don't want to do, you know, Missing by Everything But the Girl because it's a great song, but it doesn't really fit. And, you know, I'm not doing Bend to the Desert on a Horse with No Name because,
cliched. So what was that, Natalie Merchant?
10,000 Maniacs, which was Natalie Merchant was in 10,000 Maniacs before she went solo. So, yeah, that's her voice. But you know, great. Great, great band that actually went on for a little while without her, too, after she left and went solo. And that album, that In My Tribe album that song is on, is just start to finish fantastic.
No besmirchment to 10,000 Maniacs or Natalie Merchant. Big fan. Vibe was not what I was expecting to come back with, but to each their own.
No, but I am guessing, you know, you're talking about how, you know, well, the people that know the Meat Puppets know. That when we were talking about that song earlier, I don't even know if we were talking about that on air. We weren't talking about that on air. But I'll just explain. We were talking about the use of the music in the trailer for Furiosa, which has that that the Man Who Sold the World riff going to it. And Jeremy committed the cardinal sin of calling that a Nirvana song.
Which, to everybody, it is.
No.
Except for you. You're the one person that knows it as a David Bowie song.
I promise you, I am not the one person that knows it as a David Bowie song. And I of course threatened to reach through the phone and smack Jeremy because
he did.
Because he did. It is in fact a David Bowie song that Nirvana happened to cover. It's kind of like
I knew that, but I stand firm in my argument.
Yeah. So it got into, Jeremy compared it to in the same, I guess you'd almost say infamous MTV Unplugged, because it really, just got so much attention and airplay after Kurt Cobain's suicide. They played that song in that. They also played a song by the Meat Puppets called Lake of Fire. And Jeremy was comparing it, everybody thinks Lake of Fire is a Nirvana song. And it's like, I said, no, the people that know the Meat Puppets know that it's a Meat Puppet song. And he's like, yeah, but nobody knows the Meat Puppets. And
true.
So it got into this whole conversation about that. And this is one where I would give you that only like 10,000 Maniac stands would probably know that song. Because,
well, thank you, Julio.
Because it is like kind of it's an album cut. It's not a single.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a deep cut. Now, it is a deep cut on probably their most acclaimed album, and if not their most popular album, one of their most popular albums. But it is, in fairness, it's a deep cut. It's not, there was no single, there was no video. I could give you that one if you wanted to make that argument.
Well, let's turn it over to the audience at this point now. What would have been a better song, Fueled by Metallica or that one song by 10,000 Maniacs that Julio just played?
Okay, that's fine. You can email us at gopensacola@gmail.com. I will set up the spam filter so anybody that says Metallica just goes straight to spam. That's it. And then we'll count the votes. We'll count the votes that go into the actual email box. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, I mean, I recognize we've gotten way off target of what we intended about talking here, but Metallica, there's everything before the Black Album, there's the Black Album itself, and then there's everything after the Black Album.
Fair.
Yeah. And some of it is the Cliff Burton of it all. In fairness, Cliff Burton was gone by the time, unfortunately, taken from us way too soon. Gone before the time of the Black Album. But I think the Black Album is a pretty great piece of, it's a great record, great album from start to finish. But then after that, it's just like Metallica is one of these bands that they got rich and didn't have anything to be angry about anymore.
Yeah.
And it just kind of all goes downhill from there. And they tried to like still be the anger because the anger is what made them.
They even had a song called Saint Anger.
They did. And it was terrible.
Can we talk about the movie?
Yeah, but I'm gonna make one more comment about Metallica before we do.
Go ahead.
There are many people that have said that if they had a time machine, what they would do is go back in time and convince Lars Ulrich and Cliff Burton to switch seats on the bus. Which is dark. Don't get me wrong. But I could see merit to it.
Oh my God.
Wouldn't be my first choice. Not the biggest injustice in the history of mankind, but if you got the time anyway. I'm so going to get pilloried for this, but it's okay. It's fine. I'll take it. I will take my Lars Ulrich hatred, to the grave. Where Cliff Burton unfortunately is. Let's move on because we really did want to talk about Furiosa. Movie, of course, the latest film in the Mad Max series. It isn't, to give it its full title, Furiosa, a Mad Max Saga. This is the first Mad Max film where Mad Max is not a central character.
It's also the first where there's a narrative through line that connects the two of them in a way that none of the other Mad Max movies has. So that's kind of interesting. This was a movie that was maybe a couple years too late. The budget was about $170 million, opening U.S. box office 32.3, international $65 million. So got a little ways to go before we're breaking even, which I think is a conversation that we'll discuss a little bit later on in the show. But what are your general thoughts about the movie?
I loved it, man. It is, you know, they call it a saga. It is a saga. This is a film yes. that takes you from Furiosa at about age 8 directly up to the opening of Fury Road.
Yeah.
I mean, to the extent that, and this is not really a spoiler, the end credits are spliced together with actual scenes from Fury Road.
Interesting choice.
Yeah.
Which is
also interesting because it really means in the course of this film, you have three different actresses playing Furiosa.
It does.
Because of course, this being a prequel, they didn't want to do the whole DH thing and bring back Charlize Theron, which really wouldn't have worked for the first part of the movie anyway, in which the character is not played by the purported star of the film, Anya Taylor-Joy.
The girl's name is Alila Brown, and she really does deserve a bit of acknowledgement that's being overlooked in the promotions and even a lot of the conversations online, because obviously Anya Taylor-Joy is a star. She's a rising star. She's incredibly watchable. She's been in great films. Recently, The Menu was a really good one, but I think this girl, Alila Brown, has a really good performance and actually does a lot of the, like, emotional heavy lifting and has probably more lines of dialogue than Anya Taylor-Joy does.
It's probably pretty close. I would say it's probably pretty close. Furiosa is not a very verbose character.
Correct. Yeah,
and in fact, spends a good portion of the movie pretending to be mute.
Mm-hmm.
So the performance here is really more about the action and about the physical acting, both in terms of the physicality of the role and in terms of the facial expressions and body language and things like that. So it's an interesting kind of acting that I think maybe doesn't necessarily get the kind of attention it deserves, because you don't have, you know, like big emotional monologues or anything like that.
Right.
But I think both actors do an amazing job in the role. And, you know, I just overall, I don't think you can go wrong with these films. George Martin is just such a master of this world in particular, but of this kind of epic filmmaking in general. That, you know, these films are start to finish white knuckle. They keep you guessing. And it's one of the things I really like about them. Now, we could talk about how this film compares to the previous film and where it falls in the Mad Max saga when we come back. We got to take a break. Listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire.
Okay, that's about enough of that. News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. All right, you got your equal time there, Jeremy. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. There's your Metallica.
Give me fool, give me five, give me seven, never die.
There's your late period total hambone lyrics. Not a decent guitar riff, I'll give you that. But there's your post Black Album Metallica. You happy now?
Thank you.
Proud of yourself?
Strangely ashamed at the same time, which is not what I was expecting.
Because it's not good. You just can't sit here and tell me that's as good a song as like Master of Puppets.
I would never, but I think with enough decades of separation, I appreciate it for what it is in the greater canon that is the legacy of Metallica.
The legacy of Metallica is... all right, we're not going to... Never mind. I'm not
gonna, let's talk this movie, man.
Yeah, exactly. Because we've gotten way off the topic. We really intended to spend a lot of time talking about Furiosa, and I do want to talk about Furiosa because I really did love it. But yeah, it's just so easy to get distracted by bagging on Metallica. because you know, again, the legacy is great and then garbage. You know.
So
let's move away from that.
So
we were talking about Furiosa and what we thought of the movie overall. And it's really interesting because, like, I definitely love the movie start to finish. Like I said, it kept me guessing. It took me places I wasn't expecting to go. It brought in some new characters that I found really interesting. I thought Chris Hemsworth did a fantastic job playing the main antagonist of this movie, Dementus. He is just like over the top in a really good way that really fits this world.
And kind of like a fool, kind of a bad leader. He's a lot different than Immortan Joe in the fact that Immortan Joe in particular in Fury Road was kind of like this mythic cult leader, very like dark, ominous, more of a presence than
authoritarian
a character,
and
we've
evil.
Got this fool.
Yeah, he's authoritarian and evil, and that's what Dementus wants to be, but he wants to couch it in this populism. Like, you know, we're all going to share in the wealth and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, but he's an idiot.
Yeah.
And there is a way you can look at that as maybe being an allusion to, you know, someone else you might have heard of. I'm not going to spell it out for you because this isn't that kind of show. But yeah. Yeah, and it's not something I really, to be honest with you, it's not something I thought about while I was watching the movie.
Mm-mm.
But it's there.
So we mentioned Dementus as the main antagonist of this movie. We've also got the return of Immortan Joe. However, Hugh Keith Byrne passed away. I don't know if I pronounced his name correctly. He passed away between the last movie and this one, so he's actually been replaced by an actor named Lockie Holm, maybe?
And again, you're talking about a younger version of the character, so that makes some sense, too.
It does. How did you feel about the portrayal switching hands?
I thought that he was great. You know, Immortan Joe is not like a major driving force in this movie. He's not in a lot of scenes, so it worked just fine. You know, we did see some characters back from the original movie. There's two characters in this movie that really just creep me the heck out. And they're both very minor characters. But one was a character who was in Fury Road as well. He's the big, heavyset, bald guy that's like Immortan Joe's like major domo, I guess, for lack of a better term.
I think his name is the Skin Trader, and he wears this three-piece suit with little holes cut out for the nipples.
Yeah, and he's
just
constantly
does not stop playing with him through the whole movie. It's
he's missing his nose. He's got like a gold piece over his nose, and he's constantly fondling himself, and it's just makes my skin crawl. And then the other one was the, of course, the War Boys are in this. The War Boys are like Immortan Joe's like kamikaze army, basically. They're out, they're cannon fodder. They're out there to be killed and die for Immortan Joe. And they've been brainwashed to believe that that's going to bring them glory in the afterworld. And one of the War Boys in this movie is somebody that has dwarfism. And he just like pops up in these weird little places, and like he just creeps me out, man. Like I have no problem with people with dwarfism. I've got friends with dwarfism, but this particular character just is, it's not that he has dwarfism. It's the way this character acts that just creeps me the heck out.
You know, this movie, I feel like there's been a bit of a criticism about the pacing of it. And I understand why you would look at a 2.5-hour movie and feel like perhaps it's 20 minutes too long. I kind of like that it has a little bit more world building and a little bit more character building in it. But on the point of the world building, I feel like if you stripped out all of the scenes that weren't just action sequences, you would be left with essentially Fury Road, so it's got everything that Fury Road has in it, though it's familiar. We've kind of already seen it before with Fury Road, but then it takes it further than that by like, introducing us to different little parts of this wasteland and the way the kind of politics work behind the scenes. And I found all of that stuff super fascinating. I don't know. I hate to compare it to Fury Road, but
you have to.
It's inevitable, right?
Yeah.
So I think my feeling is that Furiosa, a Mad Max story, is a slightly more enriched experience. I think there's more to it to enjoy than Fury Road, personally.
I think that's fair, but I also think Fury Road is a slightly better movie. I just think it has a slightly better story. It's a little bit more cohesive and a little bit more focused. I did not at any time feel like this movie was overlong, even though it is about 2.5 hours long. I was absorbed in it every moment, and I think it is by far the best desert set epic released this year, starring Anya Taylor-Joy. Because it's not the only one.
Wait, what's the other one?
Dune 2.
Oh, yeah. Starring Anya Taylor-Joy might be a bit of a stretch, but point taken.
Yeah, but she is in the film. So yeah.
She is in the film, and that's tough, Leo. Those are two of like the best movies this year. So, I don't know.
I think this is a better film than Dune 2, personally.
Interesting.
I mean, I know that that's probably not going to be a majority opinion. Like, I get it. Like, people are way more gaga over Dune 2 than I am. I don't think Dune 2 is in any way a bad movie. I enjoyed it. From a technical standpoint, it's brilliant. I like Denis Villeneuve. I just think this is a better, more absorbing, more entertaining film.
Is there another one in the tank? Like, could George Miller do a third movie in this Mad Max saga that was set in this same version of the universe?
Well, I mean,
especially in light of what the recent box office has shown us.
Let's look at the overall Mad Max franchise so far, first of all.
Sure.
This is a remarkably consistent franchise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially when you consider the amount of time that it stretched out over and what the roots of it are versus where it is today.
Yeah.
Because the first Mad Max film was made for about $1.25.
Yeah, and I mean, everybody thinks about Road Warrior as like the defining movie because, yeah, Mad Max is a very, very low-budget, stripped-down exploitation movie.
Yeah, $1.25, and I mean like $1.25 Australian, not American.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know what the exchange rates are. So maybe that's worth more, but, you know, whatever. But if you're looking at this is a 5-film franchise at this point, and if your weakest point in your franchise is a movie that's as good as Beyond Thunderdome, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
I mean, yeah. And Beyond Thunderdome's a good flick. It's, yeah, I definitely, you know, you got to put something on the bottom of the pile, and I think that's the one that's on the bottom of the pile.
Tina Turner's so good in that movie. Yeah. Everything else aside, she's great.
But it's a good flick. So
mm-hmm.
Martin says he's got more stories in him.
Miller,
excuse me. I always want to make that mistake. I'm so sorry.
It happens.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the Beatles producer George Martin when I do that. It's George Miller.
And I thought you were talking about GRRM. That was my first thought. But
no, but that's another one that comes in there and throws it off. So yeah, George Miller says he's got more ideas for more stuff in this world. I for one would love to see it. I don't know that Warner Brothers is shelling out again unless this has a massive second week and just really takes off and just is taking some time to find its audience, because opening weekend, I think, given the amount of money that they spent on this movie, has got to be considered a bit of a disappointment. Like you said, I think 32 million in the US and 65 million worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
Now Fury Road took some time to find its audience. Don't get me wrong. So, you know, Fury Road didn't start out too much higher than this. So it could be this kind of thing where the word of mouth is going to grow and it's going to build. But I think even in just the, 10, 11 years since Fury Road,
mm-hmm.
the world of movie going and the world of filmmaking and the box office has just really, really, really changed. And I think that's going to make a difference in how this ends up doing in the long term. We are going to talk more about that when we come back, because I think it's an issue that Jeremy and I have really been wanting to talk about for some time. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. And Jeremy, for some reason, that is the biggest needle drop of the year. Been heavily featured in two movies this year. Kisses, I Was Made for Loving You. Used earlier this year in Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire. Is that the right name of it? Am I getting that subtitle?
Yeah, no, that's right.
And then more recently in The Fall Guy, which is, I know we let out of talking about Furiosa, but Fall Guy falls into the same category of what I want to talk about here in terms of these movies that are big, big movies that the studio spent a lot of money on that are coming out. They're getting great reviews. The people that are going to see them in the audience are getting on social media and telling people how much they love these movies. And yet they're not making money. Like not enough people are going out to the theaters to see them.
Mm-mm.
And just trying to understand what that was. And I kind of alluded to it a little bit before the break. That, yeah, Fury Road also took some time to find its audience, and then it got all the Oscar nominations and everything, and, you know, it built over time and made, you know, $360 million, I think, in the box office worldwide.
Which is a reasonable hit.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously enough to make them want to spend $170 million on another movie.
Wild.
Yeah. But in that ensuing 11 years, especially because of COVID and this time where we had all these films that were going straight to streaming or, you know, very limited window, people will decide that they just don't want to go out and spend the money and they're just going to wait till it comes on streaming. And I kind of wonder if that's not what's going on here in some small part. To the extent that I think Universal released Fall Guy, if I'm remembering correctly, 17 days after it was in theaters, they said, oh, well, you know what? The hell with it. We're putting it on VOD. And so you can, even though it's still in theaters, if you choose to rent Fall Guy at home to watch. It's not on a streaming service like Netflix or anything like that yet. But if you want to do like the pay-per-view rental, you can do that.
Which is actually, even at $20 a pop, oftentimes a much cheaper way to screen a movie, especially with family and things like that. When you consider your drink is $7.50, and if that's the only thing you get, then you're getting off a little bit easier by taking a date to the movie and each getting a soda.
Well, and certainly, you know, depending on where you live too, because, you know, thankfully here in Pensacola, our tickets are, you know, for a primetime showing, what, $11-$12?
Mm-hmm.
You go to a major city, you're talking more like $17, $18, $19 a ticket.
Yep.
And maybe more than that if you're going to a premium large format like IMAX or Dolby or you know, something like that. So yeah, then you're talking about, for the price of one ticket, you can rent it and watch it with the entire family.
With something like Fall Guy in particular, I feel like maybe a home screening isn't the worst thing. With something like Dune or Furiosa, you're really doing yourself an injustice by not going and seeing it on the biggest screen possible if you're a movie fan.
Well,
now, speaking anecdotally, I wanted to mention that the YouTube film criticism space was something that was massive. And there was a huge synergy between Marvel movies and even DC movies at the time that were driving audiences and created this whole outside industry where people were able to monetize talking about films that were going to the theaters. And just, you know, not to get too in the weeds on that, but I say that to say that industry has started to kind of die out, and I'm starting to realize there really was a significance in the way that Marvel was able to drive audiences to the theater and drive engagement. And now that that surefire thing has seemingly kind of fizzled out a little bit, I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, I think the big test that we're going to have with that in particular is going to come in about a month and a half when Deadpool and Wolverine comes out.
So is that the litmus? Is that the actual meter? Like, you and I will be able to know about the future of movies moving forward depending solely on how Deadpool and Wolverine performs after these last couple of big budget movies that have substantially underperformed?
Not solely, but I think it is an indicator of the future of Marvel, for sure.
This was the lowest Memorial Day weekend in three decades, excluding pandemic time. So a little bit misleading of a headline, but considering the outside factors, it makes sense.
And you had another fairly big movie in the marketplace in the Garfield movie, which, you know, I have no interest in seeing, but, you know, it definitely was an anticipated family title. And that did just a little bit under what Furiosa did.
Pixar is not able to bring people to the theaters anymore.
Well,
they were a surefire
thing
for a
little
while.
That's not Pixar.
Conflate the two,
Don't pin that garbage movie on Pixar.
No. But that's why we're getting this huge slate of sequels to Pixar movies, is because the last several, nobody even saw them. Like, I happened to catch Elemental at home, and it was pretty good, but it seems like even those surefire things, even your last couple MCU movies, they're just not performing at the level that they were 10 years ago.
Well, again, during the pandemic, you had three Pixar movies that Disney just decided to put straight on Disney Plus. You had
Turning Red, Elemental, and I don't remember.
No, Elemental wasn't one of them. It was Turning Red, Soul, and Luca.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and, you know, I haven't seen Luca, but Turning Red and Soul were both great.
Luca's pretty good as well.
Yeah. So, there's no one answer to everything. One of the things I think with Fall Guy that may have been something that kept audiences away, and in fairness, it was something that, like, might have kept me away, because I wasn't that interested in the film before it came out. It just happened to be, like, the film that was coming out that week. So, and I try to see something every week. But, you know, when you put this movie out called The Fall Guy, which was obviously, you know, the title of a TV series, you know, you're expecting, oh, here's yet another, you know, Hollywood's out of ideas. Here's a, you know, remake of an old TV series and, you know, whatever. And this film is so much more original and fresh than that, that I think
I had no idea that it was based on a TV show.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, too. It's like either you're over 45-ish and you remember the TV show, or you don't know what the heck it is, because it's not like one of those TV shows that has just remained in the pop culture consciousness.
Right.
But that's why they did the Unknown Stuntman song at the end. That was the theme song from the original TV series. Yeah, so that's Blake Shelton covering the song that, you know, Lee Majors was the star of the original series. He actually sang the song in the original series. And that was why you had that cut scene at the very end, a little bit of a spoiler here, with the two cops that show up there at the end. And you notice how they were paying a lot of attention to those cops. It's because it was Lee Majors and Heather Thomas who were the stars of the show.
Did not even know that.
Yeah.
I love this movie, though, by the way. And I know you said it at the top. These are movies that, like, should have gotten love. I mean, Furiosa and Fall Guy in particular are two recent movies that have come out that have been just a joy to watch with an audience. So I guess we're just going to have to kind of continue to see this. If this trend continues to go in the same direction, I think it's kind of bleak, unfortunately.
Yeah, I would say Fall Guy is super fun. It's super smart. And I will take a little bit of exception to what you said earlier about maybe watching it at home is fine. I think that watching this on a smaller screen, even though a lot of us have, you know, bigger screen televisions in our homes now, nobody's got a screen as big as a theater has. And I think that some of the stunts in this film are so epic that seeing them on a smaller screen diminishes them.
I am with you on this conversation and also trying to look at it through the lens of somebody that's like, hey, maybe I could wait for this one to come to streaming. If I'm going to go see one movie in the theater this month, is it going to be Fall Guy or is it going to be Dune 2 kind of situation? Some of them I just feel like are so reliant on that extra aspect. Though to your point, I'd rather see every movie with an audience. So I really hope that things don't, I hope theaters don't close. That would suck.
Well, and I can get, you know, the budgetary side of it. And I can get, you know, if I'm only going to see one movie this month, that kind of thing. But like, we're talking Fall Guy was released in April. So what was the April release that you went and saw? It wasn't Dune 2 instead because... Mm-mm. So did you just not go to the movies in April at all?
Yeah.
I mean, there was at least one other great movie in April, which was Challengers, but I think Challengers arguably is something you could have watched on a smaller screen, although
that's
I very
much
enjoyed it on the big screen. And it's not like that, you know, raked in the dough either. So
yeah, Fall Guy should have been the April movie, if that's the logic. One a month, Fall Guy should have been that one.
Yeah. We'll see what happens in the long term. I don't think theaters are going anywhere. I think as long as there are first dates, there are going to be theaters. As long as you don't want to have a stranger into your house, you know, that you just met on Tinder, there's going to be. But,
that's a good point.
You know, we'll see. But it's an interesting topic. And I really hope people do go out and find both of these movies wherever they find them, because they're definitely worth seeing and they're definitely worth your time. Hope you enjoy them. Next couple of weeks, we're going to dig in depth on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We've got some fun stuff to talk about with that, but we are done for this week. Until then, you're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.